This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, with our new weekly report on our president and the people who say no to him. Later in this hour of Trump Watch, Jane Mayer of The New Yorker will report on dark money and Donald Trump. The big money donors didn't want him, but he won anyway. What does that tell us? Also, Amy Willens will talk about Ivanka, our de facto first lady. What can she possibly do for women who work? First up, today in Trump world. For that, we turn to Harold Meyerson. He's executive editor of the American Prospect and a regular contributor to the LA Times op-ed page and other publications. We reached him today in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome to the program. You are our first Trump watcher.
I am honored in every way except for the fact that I wish we didn't have to watch Trump.
That's a good point. Well, yeah. I think today in Trump world, the number one thing has still got to be Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee. We don't like Neil Gorsuch. We've heard a lot about him for the last couple of days. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley has been saying for a while now he will filibuster the vote on Neil Gorsuch because Gorsuch does not deserve confirmation. Merkley says that's because the process that led to his nomination was illegitimate. You want to remind us what this is about? And then my question is, how is it looking for other Democrats joining Jeff Merkley?
Well, in terms of reminding what this is about, nearly a year ago, shortly after the death of Antonin Scalia, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell and Republicans said they wouldn't consider it because Obama was in the last year of his presidency, overlooking or simply refusing to deal with the fact that there had been 27 nominations of Supreme Court justices in the last year of presidents' terms in office in American history. 24 of those nominees were confirmed. Three had hearings, and the vote went to the floor and were defeated. And only Merrick Garland received no consideration at all because the Republicans decided to just wait it out. So, you know, that in a sense is, from my point of view, the most telling argument against confirming Judge Gorsuch, overlooking the many issues on which he has a sort of Scalia-like, vaguely medieval viewpoint that he wants to impose upon the American people. Then as to the filibuster, I'm sure there are actually any number of Democrats who would join Senator Merkley in filibustering. However, President Trump, who we are now officially watching on the Trump Watch
program here,
President Trump has said, in essence, well, Mitch McConnell, you should simply get rid of the 60-vote threshold for Supreme Court justices. You should change the Senate rules so that Supreme Court justices can be confirmed by a simple majority, by 51 votes. And since there are 52 Republican senators, that would do it. And I suspect Jeff Merkley and any number of his colleagues will indeed try to filibuster. And when the Republicans cannot break that filibuster, they will then change the Senate rules and put Judge Gorsuch on the Supreme Court with their own votes and not needing votes from any Democratic senators.
As you say, there's lots of reasons to object to Neil Gorsuch. One tiny one that I noticed in the paper today, Trump's Supreme Court pick Neil Gorsuch founded and led a club he called Fascism Forever when he was at Georgetown Prep, the all-boys D.C. prep school. This was Fascism Forever apparently was aimed at liberal faculty. I don't know how many liberal faculty there could be at Georgetown Prep, which I believe is a Catholic school. Do you know anything more about Fascism Forever? Those guys there, they were just the laugh riot.
Well, I actually have met years ago a guy who had been a teacher for years at Georgetown Prep, and he was fairly liberal, so we've established that.
Okay. And secondly,
you know, I mean, I think this is the, you know, the kind of thing that 16-year-olds do. However, we should note that if Neil Gorsuch was waiting all these years for a president with fascist tendencies to appoint him to the court, he seems to have found his guy. I'm not concerned so much about fascism and Judge Gorsuch. I'm much more concerned about fascism and Donald Trump, who is exhibiting all kinds of neo-quasi-semi-fascistic tendencies.
You wrote an important piece of reporting for the American Prospect website, prospect.org, that went up today on the related subject of Trump's attempt to recruit unions, to split the union movement so some will support some, not just of white workers, but some actual unions will support his side. He invited members of some of the construction trades to the White House. I was very surprised. I hadn't read about this before. What is the story here? Who did he invite, and how did it turn out?
Well, he invited five leaders of construction unions. One, the head of the AFL-CIO's building trades department, the president of the laborers, the carpenters, the painters, and the sheet metal workers, now that I think about it. He said things will be getting better. We will be doing more construction, more infrastructure construction. And this is of particular concern to the building trades because given the declining membership of American unions, including construction unions, about the only jobs on which unionized construction workers are hired these days are government-funded infrastructure programs. Everyone else tends to use non-union workers. So that was obviously of interest. Then, of course, there are sort of a whole range of problems that this really brings in its wake. The head of the building trades of the AFL-CIO, Sean McGarvey, there's a kind of Hibernian Hall character to, by the way, to the building trades leaders. They are disproportionately Irish Americans, as building trades leaders have been since about 1870, I think. Sean McGarvey asked, would you support a continuation of the Davis-Bacon Act, which is an act that's been around since 1931, signed by Herbert Hoover, which guarantees essentially decent pay for workers on federally funded construction projects. And Trump wouldn't answer. The Republicans have been trying to get rid of this for a very long time. Already, you know, this was kind of a mixed blessing to the building trades leaders. Secondly, Trump in particular, I think, and Steve Bannon, his more than neo-fascist consigliere,
yes,
I think are modeling what they're doing on what they see as Nixon's ability to win over hardhats enraged by anti-war press protesters back in the early 1970s. What they're after, you know, since this is essentially a white nationalist administration, is really splitting the labor movement along racial lines. There's no question that Trump clobbered Hillary Clinton among working class white voters, and in the course of doing this article, I actually got the breakdown for unionized working class white voters, which hadn't been published before.
Yeah.
And he won them very handily as well, I think 58%. It's not a lot of people these days. That's 7% of the overall electorate.
But there's one thing I have to ask you here. Yeah. Some of the building trades are white, but aren't there a lot of Latinos involved in the building trades these days? There certainly are here in Southern California.
Not just in Southern California, here in Washington, D.C. as well. And that's where the real complexity comes in. I particularly focused on Terry O'Sullivan, who is the president of the laborers. The laborers are a union of about 500,000 workers, around 40% of whom nationally are Latino. In doing the piece, I encountered a few Latino members who were really not happy that Terry O'Sullivan had met with Donald Trump. And to his credit, Terry O'Sullivan has always been terrific on immigrant rights, on a comprehensive immigration reform that gives immigrants who are here without documentation the right to claim full citizenship and all of that. Then, you know, here's Donald Trump wooing him, he's it's a real conundrum. And wooing him on two projects which most people concerned about the future of the planet are very dubious, the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota pipeline, which also raises questions of treatment of Native Americans. But the third project, which he didn't bring up, which would be even more explosive for a union that is heavily Latino, is the wall on the border. Now, you know, national unions have condemned this, and then Rich Trumka came out with a statement a little while ago. He's the president of the AFL-CIO, saying, you know, condemning the travel ban, the Trump's attitude towards immigrants here in the country, and the wall. You know, where the building trades are on this is a good question. Some of their white members would be, I think, probably okay with that. Some of their Latino members might be okay with that. I think a lot of their Latino members would not be okay with that.
Well and especially, let me just interject here, especially if they're not going to get the wages that the Davis-Bacon Act entitles them to. If they're going to get jobs, but these jobs are going to pay them low wages, and they're going to be walling out their relatives on the Mexican side. That doesn't sound like a very good deal to me.
It's not a very good deal. I think the trades are I think they did the wrong thing, but they're in a sort of understandably fearful position. Here's Trump meeting with them and saying, okay, I'm going to create a lot of jobs for your members on the one hand. On the other hand, he is not committing to their getting decent pay, and he is asking them to have a rather dismissive attitude towards the threats he is, de facto he's asking them, not directly, to the threats he's delivering to a lot of their members, who, if they themselves are not undocumented, and probably most of them are not, I'm sure they surely have family and friends who may well be.
Yeah.
A lot of construction work in this country is not only done by minorities, but by immigrants. What really Trump and Bannon are after is a racial division, not only of the working class generally, but if they can help bring down unions a notch or two or three, that's been the Republican ballgame for some time, and even more so today.
And as you point out in your piece, the trades Faustian bargain, it's up now at prospect.org, Trump invited the building trades leaders in on just the fourth day of his presidency, which shows the kind of priority they are giving to recruiting working class and indeed union working class support. Thank you for that. And people who want to know more about it, read Harold Meyerson at prospect.org. Now it's time for your Minnesota Moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul. The state of Minnesota announced yesterday it's suing the Trump administration over the executive order that temporarily bans refugees and travelers from seven predominantly Muslim countries from entering the United States. The Minnesota Attorney General, a woman named Lori Swanson, said last night she was joining the attorneys general of the states of Washington, New York, Virginia, and Massachusetts. They say Trump's executive order is unconstitutional. that it violates the, their case argues that it violates the Fifth Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which abolished and prohibited using a nation of origin as a basis for immigration quotas. And the states, all of these five states, are seeking a temporary restraining order to block enforcement of the travel ban at airports across the United States. I spoke recently with David Cole. He's the national legal director of the ACLU. And, of course, it was the ACLU that won those four temporary restraining orders on Saturday. He said they never would have won those if there hadn't been those massive demonstrations at airports. He said judges do not want to go up against the president if they think nobody cares. So an interesting political world we are living in. Harold, what did you make of those protests on Saturday?
Oh, I thought they were utterly necessary and really highlighting not only the injustice in a kind of abstract way, but it helped make it it personal, and you know, focusing on the you're breaking up families, you're keeping students already enrolled in colleges, and you know, from going to them. I think David Cole's point is right. We're in a period where there is now a symbiotic relationship between people on the streets, between protesters, and what public officials, even judges, actually do. And that's important. And I know, sitting here in D.C., I should add, you know, we are looking at a whole series of planned marches now, as well as spontaneous marches. Trump has certainly brought people to the streets, and that's an important part of fighting back. It's obviously not the whole thing, but it's necessary.
We've only got 2 or 3 minutes left here. I want to just note that while we've talked about the undocumented and the low-wage laborers in the United States, at the other end of the economic spectrum in America is the horrible billionaire Betsy DeVos, who Trump has nominated to be education secretary. I saw that two Republican senators yesterday said they would vote against her, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. What do you think is going to be the fate of the horrible billionaire Betsy DeVos?
Well, my understanding is that they came out against once Mitch McConnell was assured that he had just enough votes to get her confirmed. That is to say, 50 votes with Vice President Mike Pence breaking the tie. Maybe that's still a fluid situation, but I think it's going to be tough to block her. I think if there's anyone who the Democrats can block, it might be Andy Puzder, the labor secretary nominee, whose hearing keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed, and who has expressed a clear preference for robots over workers in workplaces, which you would think is even on a bipartisan basis may not be what you want in a labor secretary, but we shall see.
Harold Meyerson, he has a piece at the L.A. Times op-ed page yesterday, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, how California can fight the extreme provocations of Donald Trump. Thank you, Harold, for being our first Trump watcher.
It's been an honor.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, Dark Money and Donald Trump. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK. We are streaming live at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. One personal note, my favorite chant from the demonstrations last weekend, "We want a leader, not a creepy tweeter." Thanks to Heidi Tinsman for sending in, "We want a leader, not a creepy tweeter." Later in this hour, Amy Willens talks about Ivanka, our de facto first lady. But first, dark money and Donald Trump. For that, we turn to Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of several award-winning and best-selling books, including the indispensable book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Her latest book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, was named one of the 10 best books of the year by The New York Times. It's out now in paperback. Jane Mayer, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Well, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone made a striking argument here that we want to get your reaction to. He said Trump's victory was a victory for democracy because it proved that you don't need to have the assent of the donor class in order to win the presidency. In the past, if the rich donors rejected a candidate, that candidate was not going to win. Of course, Matt and all the rest of us recognize that Trump was exactly the wrong person to be president, but he did win despite the fact that big money didn't want him. You are our expert on the donor class. So let's talk about this, which is the subject of the new preface to the paperback of Dark Money. First of all, it is true that Trump rejected the big money donors during the primaries and during the campaign. Isn't that true?
Well, it's also true that Trump is not exactly a representative of the pauper class.
That's a good point.
He's a billionaire who spent $66 million of his own money to get elected and has behind him a hedge fund manager, Robert Mercer. One of his biggest backers is Mercer, who runs the hedge fund Renaissance Technologies in New York, which is the most lucrative hedge fund in the country, according to many write-ups. So he had many, many, many millions of dollars at his disposal and spent many of them. It is true that he was not the favorite of the Koch brothers, who I write about in my book.
Yeah, let me ask you, who was the favorite of the Koch brothers? Did they have a candidate in the primaries?
Well, this is there's a point I want to make about that. In terms of this last year, their favorites would have been pretty much probably Scott Walker or maybe Marco Rubio, someone who sort of shares their hatred of big government and wants to get rid of social programs that are expensive for middle class and poor people. They want to get rid of what they call entitlements, meaning Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. So they were looking for someone sort of in that mode, and someone who wants to get rid of regulations on business. So Trump checks off that box for them. But they like free trade. They like cheap labor. They like they have a huge multinational corporation, the second largest private one in the country, and so they like globalization. It's worked well for them, so that's why Trump wasn't really their choice. But what I wanted to say was, if you go back to 2012, Charles Koch's first choice for any politician in the country to run for president was Mike Pence.
Mike Pence was their first. The Koch brothers. First choice in 2012. That is pretty darn interesting.
So Trump may not be reliably in their pocket the way that they would like him to be, they're very happy to have Mike Pence right there at his elbow. And many, many, many more of the people that have been in their donor circle and the lobbyists and operatives who've worked for them are crawling all over the Trump administration.
Well, just before we get to what's happened since the election, I just want to talk about the campaign a little more, where Trump, didn't he actually ridicule the other candidates for going to visit the Koch brothers and asking for money?
One of his tweets was when some of his rivals in the Republican primaries were all flocking to the Kochs. Have a donor summit where basically candidates they audition to see if they can get their backing, their money backing, and so his rivals were heading out there and he wasn't invited. So he tweeted, "Puppets, anyone?" And, which
you know, you have to laugh at. And I talk about in the very end of the book how the book came out a year ago, so it was long before the election, but it seemed possible that the base of, and actually people in both parties were so fed up in this country with big donors seeming to own the whole system, that by Trump playing to that anger, he could get some traction. And he milked it a lot during the campaign. I mean, he talked a lot about, you know, big donors being corrupt and government being bought and sold, and he mostly used this as an argument against Hillary Clinton, saying that she was bought and paid for, and that in fact he, you know, tried to buy and pay for many of these politicians himself. So he used that corruption argument to get himself elected, and I think in a way you can see parallels between him and Bernie,
yeah.
Where both of them were getting traction on that, and I think they both sensed a very real and legitimate feeling out in the country, which is the big money's, you know, it's got too much influence over the government. It's getting the government to serve private interests, not the public interest. So Trump played into that a lot. And part of the reason it worked so well for him was that it was true.
Yes.
You know, in that there, we've gone through these years where the big money has gotten more and more influence, especially since the 2010 Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. So that's what the book is that I wrote, was describing this corruption, and you know, it would be nice to think, like Matt Taibbi, that somehow Donald Trump spells, you know, the clean house and clean hands, but boy, it is so far from it.
So the Koch brothers didn't support Trump really over political differences. They are in favor of free trade. Trump is against free trade. They want to cut Medicare and Social Security. Trump, during the campaign at least, said he would defend Medicare and Social Security. What did the Koch brothers do during the campaign?
They poured money into Senate races and House races and gubernatorial races and even local races. I mean, they have gotten down to the school board level in some parts of the country. What they've been doing is building a political machine to kind of take over politics at every level in the country. And the truth is, though people don't really know this often, they've never really been able to buy a president. They've never really even played in a very big way in the presidential race. This year was going to be the year they were going to try for that in a big way. And they had put together a jackpot to spend on it. But then what happened was the wrong guy got the nomination from their standpoint. So instead, they poured that money into races at all the other levels. And it's really Congress where you can see the huge clout that they've bought. And you can see it also in things like, look at the current EPA choice that Trump appointed, Scott Pruitt. I mean, he is so much the Koch person. So anyway, but during the campaign, they sat out, as far as the presidential race, they just kind of set a pox on all their houses in terms of, but they didn't like Hillary, obviously, and they're way to the right of the Republican Party. So they had pulled the Republican Party way to the right. And Trump, part of it was ideological. Part of it, I think, was that they felt he was unreliable. It's like what the old robber barons used to say. They hated politicians who, when you bought them, they didn't stay bought. And I think they looked at Trump and felt like he might not stay bought.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Jane Mayer. Her book, Dark Money, is out now in paperback, and we're talking about dark money and Donald Trump. So Trump said that people who went to the Koch brothers were puppets. The Koch brothers rejected Trump for his politics. How hard was it for the two sides to get together once Trump had been elected?
Well, let's put it this way. By election night, there seemed to be enough of a rapprochement between the Kochs and Trump that David Koch, he's the New York brother, he's the sometimes the richest or the second richest man in New York, depending on sort of where Bloomberg's fortune is. Anyway, David Koch was there on election night at the hotel celebrating the victory of Donald Trump. So It looked like they were going to be able to figure out a way to do business together.
And how much business have they done together in the almost 2 weeks that Trump has been in office?
Well, I mean, so much has happened. It's almost sort of dizzying. I'm here in Washington watching it. But you can see that in many respects, Tim Phillips, who heads the Koch's political organization, which is called Americans for Prosperity, Tim Phillips said, there's almost no daylight between us, that means between the Koch's and Trump, on many, many, many policies, and particularly on things like having to do with taxes and regulations, and particularly environmental regulations and policy on climate change. I mean, it's amazing how close Trump is to the kind of playbook that the Kochs have been, you know, trying to implement for years.
The Koch's main business, they have many, many businesses, but they're very big in oil and gas and the railroads which transport oil and gas. So it's the Department of Energy, as you say, the EPA and regulations in general. The Trump's Secretary of Energy pick was Rick Perry. Is Rick Perry part of Koch world?
Well, I mean, I think he's not against, you know, I mean, he's allied with them. I don't know that they've... I can't remember off the top of my head how much money they've given to Perry, but you know, anybody who protects the Texas oil business is someone that they're going to like. I think, to the surprise of many, maybe Perry in Texas also tried to help support the wind industry and the wind energy industry. And the thing is that the Kochs are against any form of alternative and particularly renewable energy. Anything that's a threat to their fossil fuel business, they oppose. And so they may have a few mixed feelings about him on that score.
We've only got 3 or 4 minutes left here. I want to talk about whether there's any signs that Trump has any reservations about embracing the Kochs or their agenda. Does he see any conflicts with the positions he took during the campaign? Does he have any concerns that his white working class base might conceivably feel betrayed about what he's doing now?
Well, I think this is it's the question I have too as a reporter. I'm watching to see whether the base that thought they were getting a populist is going to mind that his policies serve the richest people in the country. I suppose a lot will depend on what his job performance is like and his economic performance and whether he delivers on those promises. But I don't know, and I think what will matter to the Kochs is, you know, will Trump really cut spending? Will he really protect Social Security, and will he really protect Medicare as he promised middle-class voters he would, or will he go along with Paul Ryan's plan to privatize these things? So we'll see as they roll out their domestic economic programs whose side he's really on.
One last question. How important is killing Obamacare to the Koch brothers and their operation?
You know, I mean, they're all in favor of killing Obamacare. They don't like anything that suggests a strong government. They'd rather see business run things. So they've been against Obamacare, but the things that matter most to them are the things that affect their bottom line, and that has to do with energy policy, environmental policy, taxes, and regulations.
Jane Mayer, her terrific book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. It was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times, and it's out now in paperback. Thank you, Jane.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Hey, Trump Watchers, you can listen to Trump Watch anytime you want on TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, what can Ivanka Trump possibly do for women who work? Amy Willens has some answers. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues.
In a world where appearances are everything, some people will do anything to save or to salvage a reputation.
People will talk. There's no preventing it.
The School for Scandal by Richard Brinsley Sheridan, starring Julian Sands and Susan Sullivan. Next time on LA Theater Works. LA Theater Works.
Friday evenings at 9.
On Southern California Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
This is Trump Watch. Welcome back. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly with a Chicago poet talking about stress in the streets. But first, Ivanka, our de facto first lady. Amy Willens has been thinking about Ivanka, and she has the cover story in the new issue of The Nation magazine this week. Amy is a frequent guest here and a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She's also the former Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. She's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Politico, lots more. She won the National Book Critics Circle Award for her most recent book about Haiti. It's called Farewell, Fred Voodoo. And she teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
So do you think it's fair to describe Ivanka as our de facto first lady?
I do think it's fair. First of all, we know that for the next semester at private schools in New York, Melania Trump, who is the actual living wife of the president, is going to be living in New York with her, with their son, so he can finish out the year at school there. And we don't know what will be her plan after the term ends for the summer, say, and then next year. And Ivanka is the closest daughter to the president, so it's likely that she's going to be the serve as a kind of first lady figure. She says, no, 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 you'll see Melania is going to be the greatest first lady ever. I know, I admire her so. It's going to be wonderful. But I don't see it happening.
There's also the question of who lives in which town.
Yeah, who lives next door and who lives in New York. So Melania's in New York, Ivanka's in. We don't know where Donald's going to really be living. That's a question.
Ivanka left her apartment. Where was her apartment in New York?
I think her apartment, they had one downtown.
The Puck Building?
In the Puck
Building.
Does
this remind you of anything?
It's where I got married.
Thank you.
I'm not sure they're living in that one anymore, though.
They moved to Washington.
And that one, no, certainly they've moved out of their New York digs to Washington, to Kalorama, near the Obamas. That'll be fun.
And Melania, meanwhile, has stayed in Trump Tower on, what is it, Fifth Avenue in between 56th and...
Midtown, strictly Midtown, ruining New York traffic every time they have a marital visit.
So remind us where Ivanka fits into Trump world. You said she's the number one daughter. Trump is a man who's had three wives and five children. It gets a little confusing. Gary Young pointed out no black man could ever be elected president if he had three wives and five children.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Stereotypes are stereotypes.
So Ivanka fits in where?
She's Ivana's daughter, and Eric and Donald Jr. are also Ivana Trump's children. Then there's Tiffany, that's Marla Maples' daughter. So that's the only other daughter that we know of. And then there's Barron Trump, that's Melania's son.
So Ivanka kind of had her public political what do we call it?
Coming out party.
Coming out party. Thank you. At the Republican National Convention.
Her
debut, where she spoke about women's issues. It sounded sort of like being a Hillary supporter. Just remind us what that moment was like.
Right. It was a strange moment of a very, very strange convention in which they seemed to trot out people at a very fast clip who had nothing to say. And then Ivanka, looking very glam and very respectable at the same time, came out and gave this, what seemed in the midst of the craziness, to be a very rational speech about maternity leave and women's rights and empowering women who work and all the stuff that sounded very good, if anodyne, for women, and didn't sound like the Trump campaign.
And maternity leave, she has made her issue. She's been talking about it ever since. She says she's bringing it to her father, and it's going to become part of the Trump agenda. What exactly does maternity leave mean in Ivanka world?
Well, the proposal that she has been touting, and I don't know if it's changing now based on reaction to it or if it's just written in stone the way so many things are for the Trumps, but it seems to be a policy, a 6-week leave. Just by contrast, France has a 16-week leave.
This is paid leave.
This is paid
leave. 6 weeks of paid leave.
Paid leave for mothers, birth mothers, who can prove legal married status and whose jobs will not pay them this 6-week leave. So that means, if I understand it properly, and I think I do, that it excludes single mothers who are not married.
Yes.
It excludes same-sex mother families. It includes the mother, the birth mother, if she is a birth mother, but not the non-birth mother. Mm-hmm. It excludes all adoptive mothers.
Whoa.
Because they're not the birth mother.
Whoa.
Even if they are married. And it excludes all men, all fathers, all same-sex father couples, unless they happen to have managed to give birth to their child.
Not very many. And so what is the status of this? Has Donald Trump embraced this warmly and put it at the top of his agenda during his first 13 days?
Well, frankly, we've heard nothing about it.
Nothing.
The only thing we have is that Dina Powell has been hired by the Trump administration to be a senior advisor, mostly on women's issues. But she's not really a women's issues person. She comes from Goldman Sachs, not from the bank itself, but from their charitable development wing. And so she has this woman, Ms. Powell, knows a lot about giving and philanthropy, but we don't have any idea what she'll do in this kind of a job.
In your cover story in The Nation, you talk about what Donald Trump's response to Ivanka's political agenda has been.
Well, one thing he has said is, you know, pregnancy is a big hindrance to women in the workplace. And let's see, what else has he said? Well, he talks about, when he talks about sexual harassment, people have asked him, well, what do you think Ivanka would do if she had to experience that kind of thing on the job? And he said, well, one, she wouldn't experience that on the job. And two, if she did, she would be she would just go out and find another job. So this is not exactly the right response for most women who experience some kind of sexual harassment on the job, because they can't just go out and find a new job. So yes, his response has been very little.
Very little. In fact, if I could just quote your article in The Nation, you say he doesn't listen to her.
Well, that's what she says. He says, if someone asked her, she's been asked many times, like, does he listen to you? And she always says, depends on the day. That's her pat response. But we don't know. I don't get the feeling he listens to her, or much to anyone else for that matter.
The way the media have portrayed Ivanka and her husband Jared are that they are the moderate, calming influences in the Trump White House, in Trump world, and they provide a kind of balance and counterweight to Bannon, the fascist maniac. Is that your impression? Have you seen any evidence of this?
It's not my impression at all. I mean, I think Bannon obviously is kind of a cowboy, and he's out there. And, you know, if you look at Jared and Ivanka and try to ignore the kind of zombie overtones of the entire Trump next generation, they seem like a pretty moderate, middle-of-the-road, looking-ish couple. They know a lot of people. They're much more integrated into a social Manhattan scene than Trump himself was ever able to be. But I would say they're very far to the right. They're just, you know, they're business people who haven't, you know, shown that they have any power with Trump to be moderate. There's no evidence of their moderation in his behavior.
In fact, in your cover story in The Nation magazine, you respond to the argument that Ivanka is a moderating force on her family, on her father. You describe her as a loyal tail wagger for her father's right-wing train wreck.
She's an obedient daughter. Look, she's always imitated him in everything she does. She went to Wharton. He went to Wharton. Then when she graduated from Wharton, she went almost directly to the Trump Organization, where she stayed. And now she's tail-waggingly following him to Washington. She goes to the places where he has power. And she derives a lot of stuff and success from his power. So, and she went to The Apprentice. I mean, all of it is of a piece. We're not seeing her influencing him. We're seeing her following him.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Amy Willens. She has the cover story in The Nation magazine this week about Ivanka Trump. Ivanka has done one thing that her father didn't do. She markets products through the internet at ivankatrump.com. You've spent some time looking at ivankatrump.com. Tell us about it.
Well, I could spend a lot of time on ivankatrump.com. She has a brand, and she sells clothing and accessories to women her age, basically. So that's what its real motivating reason is for its existence. But beyond that, it is played as this kind of femvertising website where the appeal is to young women supposedly on the rise. And it has a lot of video content for women who work, and that's all capitalized, women who work. And she's got a hashtag, women who work. But the women who work on it, I mean, I talk in my piece a little bit about the women who work on IvankaTrump.com versus the women who work in America. And on IvankaTrump.com, they all have really pretty nice clothes, sleek trousers and cashmere sweaters and long hair that's straightened in the fashion of the day, and they are all 35 or under. Maybe one is 37. One might be 41 that I saw. I thought, whoa, that's an elderly person. No one is fat. No one looks real. No one has any reality whatsoever. But they all talk about work not as if there's ever a problem at work. So no one on IvankaTrump.com ever says, I just can't stand my boss. No one on IvankaTrump.com ever says, you know, I'm thinking my career matters to me so much, I'm not going to have a baby for a long time. It's all about women who choose to work and have their little families and are trying to balance the two. And that's, of course, it's a big issue, but it's all a very upper middle class kind of demographic that she's appealing to. Very aspirational, in fact.
Yeah. I took a look at IvankaTrump.com and that same section that you explored, Women Who Work, and I learned there that everything you need is already inside you.
Yes, it is, John. I'm so glad that John Wiener got to go to IvankaTrump.com.
It took me a long time to find out this important information. You feel that there are other kinds of working women who are somehow not part of... Hashtag women who work.
Well, I talk a little bit in the piece about another woman who works who was in the public eye for a long time, and that's Roseanne Barr, whom I had the luck to interview once here in Los Angeles. And she's quite an outspoken person. Whatever she's speaking out about at the moment, she's outspoken. And I compare the kind of women you see on IvankaTrump.com to the kind of women you saw on Roseanne Barr's show, Roseanne, in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And, you know, Roseanne had all these bad jobs. She worked in a plastic factory. I'm talking about the character, not the stand-up comedian, who is a very different can of worms. She worked in a plastics factory. At one very low point, she was a hair sweeper in a salon. She was a waitress, of course. These are the kinds of women I remember working when I was younger and living in hardscrabble New Jersey. You know, they weren't people who wore slim linen pants and cropped cashmere sweaters to work. They wore, like... polyester slacks and a sweatshirt that was more like the women who worked who I knew. And I think the women who work in America are still like that. They work in chicken factories. They wait tables, and they are not sleek, lovely givers of fanciful gifts, which is what IvankaTrump.com and her women who work hashtag would have you think.
Now, isn't there a conflict between Ivanka being an advisor to the president of the United States and Ivanka running a business using her father's name? Isn't this a potential violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution? What does she say? Does she have an official role in the White House?
She does not, on purpose, have an official role in the White House, although she has moved aside at IvankaTrump.com. So I don't know how she's working that angle, but there is a paragraph up there about how she's not really involved in the day-to-day business there anymore. So it does bear his name, but it bears her name. She gets to have a name. But she is not an official at the White House, and that's the role of her advisor friend, Dina Powell.
So if she's not officially an advisor working in the White House, and she's no longer running IvankaTrump.com, what is she doing all day? What does she say she's doing?
She's taking care of the kids. She's getting them adjusted to their new city.
How old are her kids?
They're little. They're like 7, 5 and below school age. Mm-hmm. And you know, getting them settled, finding schools for them, finding doctors. Basically what, as far as I can see, Ivanka has been retrofitted into a Trump view of what women should do in the world. She's now a mom who kind of works from home without an official position. And you know, is she going to really be in charge of women? And to me, maybe what it says is this is how much Donald Trump cares about the women issue. He's said, my daughter really advises me on women. And now he's got her in a position where she's a mom who works from home and is going to be like the first lady, maybe in charge of White House dinners. Oh, and also the women of America. Thanks.
Okay. Do you see a political future for Ivanka? I mean, her appearance at the Republican National Convention was certainly a prominent place to get started. She was interviewed by Cosmopolitan before the election about this maternity leave proposal. How did that go?
Well, first you asked, did I see a political future for Ivanka Trump? Did you see a political future for Donald Trump? Sure, I see a political future for Ivanka Trump. But she has a lot of Trumpian qualities, learned from the master, no doubt. And when she was interviewed by this reporter for Cosmopolitan, well, the reporter asked her some not entirely softball questions. The reporter mentioned that quote from Donald Trump about, you know, pregnancy is a problem in the workplace.
I would say this is the job of a journalist. You bring up the obvious.
We used to think. Ivanka got very annoyed. She said something like, I think I see you're bringing a lot of negativity to this. And shortly thereafter, she just got up and ended the conversation. It's kind of petulant, you know, very, very dad-like, very much like my father, as I call him in the piece.
In capital, all initial caps. So that kind of suggests she doesn't really have the skills to negotiate the political world where lots of people criticize you and you go on. And that's my impression, that during the campaign, they did send her out to meet with campaign volunteers, especially in North Carolina, I remember, but it's very protected, very careful. She had coffee with hand-picked campaign volunteers, and then she talked about maternity leave in those settings. That's a long way from being a candidate or even liking politics.
Right, and we don't know. I mean, her first acts as a person who's going to defend the rights of American women for the next 4 years was to have a power dinner at the Park Avenue penthouse of Rupert Murdoch's very ex-wife, Wendy Deng. with a bunch of power women from New York and some other people, including a couple of men. She didn't like get up and hold a press conference and say, you know what, I'm going out. I was out on the campaign and I met a lot of people and now I'm going to go out again and see what's happening with America's women, or I'm going to get groups together from the 50 states, women's groups, and hear from them. No, she had a power dinner and that's been it for what we've heard of what she's planning for people of my sex for the future.
She did not get together with Roseanne DeMauro, the president of the National Nurses United, to find out how things were going in the working class of women. Last question. You spent a lot of time thinking about Ivanka, reading her about her life and studying her website. Did you have any sympathy with Ivanka as the daughter of this fascistic tyrant?
Of course, you know, because she's been molded by him and she's been under his control. And even though she lived with her mom for a long time and really didn't have that much to do with Donald after the divorce, she still, you know, knew that he was powerful in her family. And so she grew up thinking of him as the director of her life. And when you look at photographs of them together, it's most disturbing because she seems to be completely like a Pygmalion figure, just looked at by him and kind of made into one of his type of women at a very young age, a little made-up dolly, you know.
It's sad. Well, her mother was a model.
Her mother was a model. Her mother, of course, always wanted her beautiful little daughter to look her best too, but pushed her forward in that way. But when you see it, her holding hands with Donald and this and wearing her get-ups, it's a little weird to me as a mother. It just strikes me weird. But I don't know. It's just I feel like she's a kind of object. She's been raised as an object.
And she certainly has no choice in this matter. She's going to be her father's daughter. And I mean, unless she's going to be like...
unless she's going to rebel in some
like
way.
Patty Davis,
right, which I don't think.
We don't see a Patty Davis in this family.
No.
Amy Willens, her piece, What Can Ivanka Trump Possibly Do for Women Who Work? Is on the cover of The Nation magazine this week. Amy, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks a lot, John.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guests. Harold Meyerson talked about Trump World today and Trump's recruiting of unions. Jane Mayer reported on dark money and Donald Trump. Her book, Dark Money, is out now in paperback. Thanks to our engineer, D'Angelo Jones, and our producer today, Alan Minsky. Thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly, today with a Chicago poet talking about stress in the streets. Hey, Trump watchers, if you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Trump Watch returns next week at this same time on this same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.